This is Stuart Millard, and you are haunted. This month's first email comes from Big Barry. I drive trucks for a living. I've done for the last 30 years. You might think, oh, so you sat on your arse all day. But let me tell you, it's a special breed of man that can keep his wits for a 16-hour stretch along the M's and A's. Fall asleep at the wheel and you'll end up nudging a bus full of kiddies down an embankment, like has happened to a mate of mine. Still bursts into tears when he sees anyone under the age of 10. When I started out, all you had to keep you company was the radio, but anyone would get sick of the same half dozen songs all day. I tried some of them books on tape, until one of the cassettes got mangled 8 hours into the stand. I couldn't be arsed after that. You're mainly driving in the dark, especially during winter, so there's not a lot of scenery to look at, and eventually you start seeing those white lines, even when you close your eyes. Might be days and days without speaking to another soul, and I suppose some people would hate that, but I enjoy the solitude. Nobody to nag, no annoying co-workers telling me about their kids or making me sign a birthday card for some twazzic in accounts. Just me in my little box as the rest of the world goes by. Sometimes I imagine I'm flying through space. If you want to make good time and good bonus, you'll get precious few toilet breaks. A few years in, I had a bladder like a medicine ball, stretched out to the capacity of about 7 or 8 pisses for a normal person. I'd hold them in so long, they practically came out black. Of course, a life on the road's not without its perks. I could tell you some stories. Oh yes, women love a truck driver. It's like being a cowboy, riding into town, no strings, no commitment, no deodorant. They're not getting any at home and looking for a quick ramen, and suddenly, there you are, pulling into services to grab an egg roll and wipe down your ball bag in the sink. Trick is to walk in like you've got a massive donger, confident stride, legs far apart like it's in the way. The ladies catch you strutting between the pasties and the CD bin, and they're thinking, yeah, I'd fancy a bit of that in the disabled toilets. Coincidentally, I've actually got a massive one for real, so they're not disappointed when it comes out. I've been up to all sorts over the years. Nowadays they call it dogging, but back then it was just a bit of rumpy and a lay-by. You used to get them hitchhikers too, but you don't see so many of them now, not since all those true crime documentaries. But I'll keep my eye out, just in case. Always hope I'll see that super nanny at the side of the road. I'm half a day into a nice long drive. Perhaps it's summer and I've got a sweat on, the shirt's off, and I sees her stood on the hard shoulder in her purple power suit. So I let her in the cab. But then I starts misbehaving, honking on the horn, fiddling with the glove box and that, and she tells me my behaviour is unacceptable. Get on the naughty step, she says. But I says I can't because I'm driving. So she says, well, we'd better have it off then. She clambers on my lap and I'm having to watch for the road over her shoulder as she's, well, anyway, I suppose I should get round to why I'm writing in. About 25 years ago now, I was coming back through France with 15 ton of boglins. It's all rural through there, grass and hills and little stone houses. Not many people, but plenty of cows and shit. It was summer, I recall. Late, but still daylight. Bloke at the warehouse had made a joke about it being the longest day of the year, and I'd said something like, aren't they all, mate? So I'm going past this one field, and something catches my eye. At first I think it's a goat, but it's got a human body, if that makes sense. And it's just sat there, till it spots me. It gets up, on 2 legs mind, and takes off after me across the field. I weren't too worried, as this thing was on foot and I was in me truck, but it seemed to be getting closer. I can't go too fast, as it's narrow little roads, but I'm still going quicker than anyone can run, than any human can run, and it's caught me right up. It's just on the other side of this wire fence, keeping exact pace with the truck, in this way that made me think it could have overtaken if it wanted. Could have got to the door. That close, I could see its face, and it was just a goat. I don't know how else to explain it. Two big curly horns, then weird eyes where the pupil goes sideways, glaring into the cab. Its legs were on back to front, covered in thick hair, with hooves instead of feet. I wonder if it's going to follow me all the way back home. Then I get across this bridge over a stream, and it just stops on the bank. I watch it getting smaller in the rearview mirror. How is it she's both posh and common at the same time? Sorry, thinking about Super Nanny again. But yeah, I don't know what it was I saw that day. This letter is from Lewis in Northampton. I'm writing to tell you about my Auntie Lynn. Sadly, she passed away a couple of years ago, but that's not what the story's about. She was my dad's sister, so a biological aunt, rather than one of those aunties or uncles that's just your neighbour or your mum's mate. Auntie Lynn lived nearby, so she'd often watch me after school until my parents finished work, or during the holidays. She never had kids of her own, and was what you might describe as a bit of a bohemian. She'd had various jobs over the years: singer, theatrical makeup artist, bricky, life model, obituary writer, wig tester, palm reader. Before I was born, she dated a Russian circus performer, and still had a cupboard filled with his old balls. I used to love going to hers, but being about 6 or 7 at the time, and having since had kids of my own, I'm sure that quite often I was being a right pain in the penis. When I was getting too much, running around making a racket, Auntie Lynn would warn me that if I didn't be quiet, I'd wake Sonny Jim, and he'd come down from the loft to see me. If you're unfamiliar with the name, Sonny Jim was the mascot for a cornflake brand called Force Cereal. They stopped making it in 2013, but it was pretty popular through the 70s and 80s. Sonny Jim wasn't one of the big ones, like Ronald McDonald or the Honey Monster, but famous enough that you could send off for a rag doll of him. He had an odd look, a thin, elderly man with a pointy nose and monocle, and dressed in a red 19th century military jacket and white slacks. His hair was the strangest thing, protruding under the back of his hat like a great white horn. Google him and you'll see what I mean. In storyline, he'd been a depressed hermit named Jimmy Dumps, until one day being served a bowl of Force cereal. And from that moment forwards, he was happy-go-lucky Sonny Jim, always depicted with a box of cornflakes clutched to his chest. This, said Auntie Lynn, was who lived in the attic. And if I was naughty, I might hear him shaking his box in anger. We've all had adults say things like that to us as kids. At that age, you'll believe any old toot. Father Christmas, the Tooth Fairy. I had this mate whose dad used to make out he was phoning Mr. T. Hello, Mr. T. Yeah, he's not been eating his vegetables again. That's right, Mr. T. He is being a fool. So when Auntie Lynn warned me about Sonny Jim, I believed it, and the fear of this horrid old man coming down to tell me off usually made me pipe down and behave. One night I was staying over in the spare room while my parents had a weekend away. After she said goodnight and turned out the light, I sat up and started reading a comic in bed, one of those Beano summer specials where all the characters go to the beach. I was supposed to be asleep, so I turned the pages as quietly as I could, using the weedy light off my digital watch. Then I heard it, coming from the ceiling right above my bed. I tossed the comic on the floor and pulled the covers over my head, where I stayed until morning. I told Auntie Lynn at breakfast how Sonny Jim had shaken his box at me. She didn't even seem surprised and asked me, "And were you behaving yourself?" by way of explanation. Even now, I remember that sound so clearly. It's funny, isn't it, the way your memories and imagination get all mixed up. bloke I work with swears blind he got Brian Harvey's autograph in the queue for Crocodile Dundee 2. But E17 weren't even famous then, so how would he know who he was? As I got older, I realised it must have been Auntie Lynn, stood outside my door. Some years later, now in my early 20s, I stayed at hers to look after the cat while she went to WOMAD. I was used to having flatmates stomping about, so to have a place to myself was bliss. Nobody to fight with a remote control, and I could watch whatever telly I wanted, which was a load of old rubbish all night until falling asleep on the sofa. It was the shaking that woke me, just like before. I shut the TV off and didn't make another sound. I'll admit I was a bit freaked out, so the next night I had a couple of friends over. Nothing wild, just a few drinks and some music, being sure not to have the volume too high. I was trying to keep things quiet, but at the same time I didn't want to hear that sound again. Eventually they had to go home, leaving me by myself, but by then the whole thing felt stupid, so I just went to bed. When I flicked on the light, Sonny Jim was waiting for me in the corner of the room. I fell onto the bed in fright as he stood there. He was so old looking, 150 if he was a day. Didn't say a word, just stared me down with this filthy look. The kind of glare my granddad used to describe as, like you've trod dog's doings all over the new carpet. Holding my gaze, his nose wrinkled in anger, Sonny Jim shook his box at me, before descending back into the darkness of the hallway, the whites of his eyes the last thing to vanish. I heard the loft hatch close behind him. I spent the rest of the week in silence, walking on tiptoes, behaving myself, and thankfully never saw him again, or heard him. After Auntie Lynn died, I had the chance to go around and see if there were any of her things I might like to have. She always had a lot of cool stuff. Theatre posters, ceramic statues of half-naked women, a corkscrew made from a dried-out duck's dick. Dad said there was loads of junk in the attic. I pretended to have a migraine. Our next tale comes to us from Bradley, in London. Straight out of university, I got a night job cleaning offices. The crew was a mix of ages and backgrounds, and everyone would meet in the lobby at 8 o'clock to be assigned our floors. We'd work a floor in pairs, starting one at each end and eventually meeting in the middle where the bathrooms were. There was quite a high turnover of staff. I didn't think much of it. For most of us it was a stopgap or second job, but pretty soon I realised that most of the people who stopped showing up were the ones who'd been working on the fifth floor. The first I heard about the reputation of the fifth floor was when one of its cleaners failed to show, leaving it a man short. Our boss nodded at this other guy, told him he'd be filling in. As soon as he heard that, he didn't say a word, just dropped his marigolds and strolled straight out of the exit. Never saw him again. I thought it was weird that nobody laughed or exchanged a look, but I just assumed it was a particularly dirty office, like maybe the toilets were really minging. I had a friend who used to clean at a college, and he once had to stand on a chair in the staff toilets to scrape human feces off a light bulb. At the time, I was up on floor 7 with a Polish guy called Laszlo, and I asked him, "What's the deal with number 5? "Bad vibes, man," he said, putting a finger to his lips and shaking his head, like we shouldn't even discuss it. I worked 7 for a while, watching as those from 2 floors below failed to show up, or sometimes left midway through a shift. Eventually, inevitably I suppose, it was my turn to get rotated in. I was paired with an older bloke called Tell, who wasn't much of a talker. His wife had not long left him for a man who cuts keys, and I heard him say he spends his weekends driving round and round the ring roads for something to do. As we got out of the lift, Tell told me to keep my head down and get on with it, so we could be finished as quick as possible. First impression of the fifth floor was it seemed perfectly fine, although most likely there was a great big jobby on the bathroom ceiling with my name on it. To save money, the building manager kept full lighting off at night, leaving its open-plan offices lit by a single strip light in the centre, meaning the rooms got progressively dimmer as you got to the edges. Some workers would leave their computers on, adding the extra glow of a Rachel Stevens screensaver, or desktop background of the Top Gear logo. One wall was all windows, just the jet black of the world outside, and when I first started, I kept making myself jump by catching my own reflection. It took a while to get used to. My role was mostly to empty the bins and run a Henry Hoover round. I remember one lad kicking off about using a Hetty, which are pink with eyelashes, refusing to work until someone swapped it for the man's version. But anyway, the first night went by without incident. Mostly. I liked to work with a podcast on, but kept having that feeling like someone had come in the room, like I was being looked at. So I'd take an earphone out and look behind me, expecting to see Tell, but finding myself alone. On the second night, I turned around to see a desk chair coming to a stop in the middle of the floor. I told Tell about it when we were breaking open a new pack of urinal cakes, but he didn't seem surprised. When I was headed back to swap out the bin bag in the kitchen, through the glass in the hallway, I saw someone inside the office, stood on top of the desk. At least, I thought I did. There was nobody there when I went inside, and the light did do mad things with all the reflective surfaces. It was night three when the Hoover kept cutting out. I thought I might have yanked it out of the socket without realising, but when I went to check, it had been switched off at the wall. Maybe Tell had done it. A couple of minutes later, it happened again. This time, I wheeled it to where I'd be able to see the plug, figuring it was one of the other lads pranking me. Shit, maybe all that stuff about floor five was just hazing, like sending the work experience boy off to buy rainbow paint. I heard one of the big supermarkets makes all the new recruits stack these genetically modified watermelons from Japan, which are invisible, as a way of weeding out people who can't be trusted to work the checkout. As long as I was watching, nobody messed with the Hoover, and I finished up like normal. Once I got out of there, soon as I was off the fifth floor, I felt light as air. But the next night, I looked at Tell as we got out of the lift, and wondered if that would be me in 20 years. Worthless degree, mired in student debt, scrubbing away other people's skids for minimum wage. The rents were so high around there, how would I ever get my own place? What a fucking loser. My poor family must be so embarrassed. Don't get me wrong, there's no shame in manual labour, no such thing as an unskilled worker. But in that moment, everything felt so bleak. So pointless. I remember staring at my reflection in the window and thinking, is this it? It was such a long way down from up there. You probably wouldn't even... Friday night shift, I don't recall much of anything. Not until the sound of Tell yelling my name. Really screaming it. When I snapped out of it, I already had one leg straddled out through the open window. I never went back. Laszlo called me the following week. He'd been cleaning the security room and gone through the tapes. We met up and he showed me a copy of my last night on the fifth floor. There I was, wiping down desks, emptying bins. And behind me, always behind me, this black shadow, like a smudge on the screen. When I was at the window, it had almost engulfed me, dissipating like smoke when Tell called my name. Some years later, there was a post on one of those spotted groups on Facebook, talking about haunted places, and that building came up. Loads of different rumours. One said it was the ghost of someone who'd hung himself during lunch break, pushed a couple of ceiling tiles loose and threaded his necktie through the beam. His colleagues came back to find him swinging. Others said it was a finance guy who took a swan dive when the banks crashed, or a sales rep that had cut her wrists in the toilets. I wonder if all these stories aren't true. And whatever resides in that office was the reason those people did what they did. Last I heard, a web design company was renting it out. One of those stupid names they all have. Adjective plus animal or fruit. Awkward Satsuma, Scruffy Beaver. Something like that. Our final story this week comes from Derek in Bath. In the early 70s, I was a second year student of history at Sheffield Uni, coming back from a night at a friend's house. I wasn't drunk. I only had a couple before saying my goodbyes and heading home. It was probably somewhere between 2 or 3 a.m. The street lights had gone out, but it was a bright moon and only a short walk. When I look back on this incident, one of the strangest things is that nothing felt strange into the lead up. I had no sense of foreboding or any feeling that anything was different. I just rounded the corner past the post office and was strolling quite idly, like one does when it's the wee hours, with the pavements all to yourself, traipsing right down the centre of roads where there's no traffic. It was also nondescript, I can't even remember the exact moment immediately before. Just that I was walking down a dark street and suddenly it was daylight, and I was in the middle of a bustling market. There was no transition, so to speak. Not even a blink. 1 second, ambling down Cohen Avenue, and then just in an entirely foreign place. I don't know if they'd seen me arrive, but it's possible that anyone staring at me had merely clocked the only white face, stood in jeans and a donkey jacket beneath the blazing sun. I staggered past stalls and people with unfamiliar fashion, smells, architecture, every sign in Oriental script, every voice gibberish to my ears. I suppose I was hoping to find some door or alleyway that led back, where I might have, I don't know, stumbled on some hidden part of the city, the Sheffield Chinatown, where it was somehow daytime. I made my way out into a busy street, with tall buildings either side and everyone going about their business. How did I get here? More importantly, how do I get home? I didn't even know where here was. As much as it sounds like a cool adventure, I was quickly sat on the ground, crying. A few people stopped with a small crowd gathering and attempting to converse with me. They found someone who spoke a smattering of broken English and was able to convey to me that I was in the Philippines. Then they bundled me onto a bus with some money and a note for the driver. And a few hours later, I was dropped outside the British Embassy in Manila. I think the officials there took my confusion for the hangover of an idiot young tourist. The notion of a lost passport came up and I just went along with it. I felt like I'd gone mad. I must have blacked out, maybe hit my head and brought on a bout of amnesia. Were my worried family looking for me after I'd wandered off a nearby hotel of some forgotten holiday? When I was offered use of the phone, I didn't want to ring my parents, so I called those same friends I'd been with. At first they thought it was a joke, but allayed and confirmed my worst fears. I wasn't losing my mind, but I had just been at their house, a place which now sat 18 hours away by plane. They came and met me from the airport after the embassy arranged for a flight home. We didn't really talk on the car journey back. In the months that followed, I went through all the sensible explanations, trying to make myself believe there was an answer. Fugue state, maybe? Or I'd been hypnotized and thrown on a plane for a ragweed prank. But the stats don't lie. 6,500 miles in the time it takes to sneeze. In the end, I had to try and make peace with the fact it just happened, and I'll never know the why. Since that day, I've always been afraid of a reoccurrence. It was so thoroughly without warning, without prompting, that I forever felt at the whim of some cruel cosmic joker, particularly in the years immediately following the Philippines incident. What was to stop me suddenly being dropped in the middle of the ocean? Or shot halfway round the world on the day of my daughter's wedding? And if you showed up in a random country today, no papers, no evidence of travel, no way of explaining why you're there, you'd be straight off to Guantanamo. Even if I'm just bringing the washing in, I've always got my passport on me. I've done a lot of reading, and there's been a handful of other instances. There was an African boy in the 80s who blinked back and forth between two different villages 400 miles apart in the space of a few minutes. Then there was a 19th century nun who claimed she'd been reading a book on a balcony in Donegal, only to find herself in Spain. older tales do talk about distressed, lost visitors babbling in foreign tongue, but there's no obvious connection between any of these travellers, myself included. I can't be positive, but I think it happened to me once more. I was approaching 50 by then, and taking an evening stroll through the countryside. I glanced behind me, and when I turned back, I'd estimate I was some 400 yards further along. Now I'm getting older, and travel is becoming rather an endeavour. A small part of me wishes it would happen again. I went through a stage right after Manila of trying to do it on purpose, like I was a bloody X-Men, and it would save a fortune on train tickets. But there's a big difference in being prepared and in what happened to me. I often think about the amount of people who go missing, never to be seen again. Adults, children. Supposedly there's about 20,000 that vanish every year, just in the UK. God knows how many elsewhere. There was one on the local news the other day. Father of two who disappeared somewhere between work and home. I mean, they usually find them in the woods, don't they? But the ones that never turn up. And some short ones to finish on. Harper writes, "Every weekend when I was a lad, my granddad would take me for a walk around town, where we'd slash tyres on parked cars or start fires. Sometimes we'd throw stones at the swans in the park. Granddad hated swans. Oh, and he died before I was born." And Dad's dick pic from Twitter says, "A skeleton lives behind the wall out back of the garages, but I don't really want to talk about it." Okay, thanks. You Are Haunted was written, produced and performed by me, Stuart Millard. To support the show and get early access to episodes, go to patreon.com/franticplanet. Find me on Twitter @franticplanet and check out franticplanet.com for my other writing. Credit for all music is in the show notes. Bye then, mate. Fucking knobber.